The Saturday morning at the Potomac Temple is Chaitanya Charitamrita morning. And this morning is Madhya Lila, chapter 21, entitled The Opulence and Sweetness of Lord Krishna. Nice thing to hear about on a Saturday morning. The beginning part, this is beginning of text 68. The beginning part of the chapter is a comparison between the three-quarter portion and the one-quarter portion of creation, the three-quarter portion is the spiritual sky and all the spiritual planets within the spiritual sky, the Vaikuntha realm, the Goloka realm, and all of the unlimited, literally unlimited number of living entities that are in pure consciousness. And then this proportionately smaller Devi Dham. And so many things, verses are quoted to identify that distinction, and that Krishna is the source of all of that. So then there's a verse spoken where the three-quarters part of Lord Krishna's energy is beyond our speaking power. Let us therefore elaborately hear about the remaining one-fourth. And the idea is to give us some idea of the three-fourths. We'll speak about the one-fourth, and one-fourth is so vast, it's inconceivable. Who can even conceive of the three-fourths? So to do that, the description is presented about once upon a time. Lord Brahma went to visit Krishna in Dwarka. Actually, it doesn't say it here, but elsewhere it's described, he received an invitation. A messenger came to Lord Brahma and said, Krishna would like to see you in Dwarka. So he was very happy. So he went to Dwarka, and he was received by a doorman, and the doorman said, just a moment, I'll go see if the Lord is available. And he went to see Lord Krishna. Immediately Lord Krishna said, please ask him, which Lord Brahma? What is his name? So the doorman went back to Lord Brahma, and that's where we are right here. Lord Brahma said, well, tell him I'm the four-headed Lord Brahma, and I'm in charge of the universe, and why did you ask that question? Are there many Lord Brahmas? Is there another Brahma besides me within this universe? That's when Brahma was then brought before Lord Krishna. So Krishna smiled, a different kind of smile than when he smiled at Duryodhana, when Duryodhana was attempting to attack him with all of his soldiers in the royal assembly. Unlimited Brahmas immediately arrived. These Brahmas had different numbers of heads. Some had 10 heads, some had 20, and then multiples. 100,000, 10,000, 100,000, 10 million, and 100 million. No one could count the number of faces they had. There also arrived many Lord Shivas with various heads numbering 100,000 and 10 million. Many Indras also arrived, and they had hundreds and thousands of eyes all over their bodies. Purport. It is said that Indra, the king of heaven, is very lusty. Once, he had sexual intercourse with the wife of the great sage, of a great sage. And when the sage learned about this, he cursed lusty Indra with a curse that put vaginas all over his body. Being very much ashamed, Indra fell down at the lotus feet of the great sage and begged his pardon. Being compassionate, the sage turned these into eyes. Therefore, Indra possesses hundreds and thousands of eyes all over his body. Just as Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva had many faces, King of Heaven, Indra, has many eyes. When the four-headed Brahma of this universe saw all these opulences of Krishna, he became very much bewildered and considered himself a rabbit among many elephants. All the Brahmas who came to see Krishna offered their respectful obeisances at his lotus feet, and when they did this, their helmets touched his lotus feet. Sariputta comments, how is this possible? Physically, they had millions and thousands and hundreds of thousands and 10 million heads, and all at once they touched his lotus feet. Either had small helmets or he had big lotus feet. Or there's something else going on with space in the spiritual world. And that was Sariputta. He didn't have, Krishna doesn't have huge feet, and they don't have small heads. Space works in a different way in the spiritual sky. And there's so many examples. Like one of the common ones from Vrindavan is, those of us who have been to Vrindavan, when you go from one place to another place by taxi, it takes some time. They didn't have taxi. But Krishna was walking with the cowherd boys, and they would go from one place to another place in short time. So the devotees asked Prabhupada, how is this? This place to that place in such a short time. Like at the Kaliya Dhamana Leela, when Krishna was in the coils of the Kaliya serpent, one of the cowherd boys went running back to Nandagram to tell Nanda and Jasoda, Krishna's in difficulty. So Nanda Maharaj, don't worry, Mother Jasoda, I'll take care of this. You can stay here at home. She couldn't stay at home. But they quickly went. And how long did it take to get from Kaliyagat to Nandagram? But very quickly. And so many other examples like that. And Prabhupada's explanation was, Vrindavan is like a lotus. Sometimes the lotus is open, sometimes it's closed. When the lotus is closed, the distances can be traversed more quickly. That was an interesting answer. But time and space in the spiritual world were completely under Krishna's control. So to accommodate Leela, some space can be made very short. And those that aren't Krishna but yogis, they can also traverse one space, point A to point B, very quickly in ways that we can't, because there are subtle material laws and they're manipulating them by their mystic powers. We discussed that a little bit yesterday evening. But Krishna's Yogeshwara. So the heads of all the Lord Brahmas touched the feet of Krishna all at once. No one can estimate the inconceivable potency of Krishna. All the Brahmas who were there were resting in the one body of Krishna when all the helmets struck together at Krishna's lotus feet. There was a tumultuous sound. It appeared that the helmets themselves were offering prayers unto Krishna's lotus feet. With folded hands, all the Brahmas and Shivas began to offer prayers unto Lord Krishna, saying, O Lord, you have shown me a great favor. I have been able to see your lotus feet. All of them then said, It is my great fortune, Lord, that you have called me, thinking of me as your servant. Now let me know what your order is, so that I may carry it on my heads, plural. Lord Krishna replied, Since I wanted to see all of you together, I have called all of you here. All of you should be happy. Is there any fear from the demons? They replied, By your mercy, we are victorious everywhere. Whatever burden was upon the earth, you have taken away by descending on that planet. This is the proof that of Dwarka's opulence, and all the Brahmas thought, Krishna is now staying in my jurisdiction. Thus the opulence of Dwarka was perceived by each and every one of them. Although they were all assembled together, no one could see anyone but himself. Purport. The four-handed Brahma perceived the opulence of Dwarka Dham. The four-headed Brahma perceived the opulence of Dwarka Dham, where Krishna was staying, and although there were many Brahmas present, having 10 to 10 million heads, and although many Shivas were also assembled, only the four-headed Brahma of this universe could see all of them. By the inconceivable potency of Krishna, the others could not see one another. Although all the Brahmas and Shivas were assembled together, due to Krishna's energy, they could not meet or talk amongst themselves individually. That's the purport. Lord Krishna then bade them farewell to all the Brahmas there, and after offering their obeisances, so many heads crashing together, they all returned to their respective homes. After observing all these opulences, the four-headed Brahma of this universe was astonished. He again came before the lotus feet of Krishna and offered him obeisances. Brahma then said, Whatever I formerly decided about my knowledge, I have just now had personally verified. So there's now a reference to something that Brahma said to Lord Krishna in a prayer maybe 100 years before that, when Krishna was just a small boy in Vrindavan, and the calves and the cowherd boys incident took place. Brahma said, There are people who say, I know everything about Krishna. Let them think that way. As far as I am concerned, I do not wish to speak very much about this matter. O my Lord, let me say this. As far as your opulences are concerned, they are all beyond the reach of my mind, body, and words. Krishna said, Your particular universe has a diameter of 4 billion miles. Therefore, it is the smallest of the universes. Consequently, you have only 4 heads. Purport. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, one of the greatest astrologers of his time, gives information from the Siddhanta Shiromani that this universe measures, this is in yojanas, let's see, 100,000, million, billion, trillion, 18 quadrillion, 712 billion, trillion, 69 billion, 200,000 million times 8. Because one yojana is 8 miles. That's the circumference of the universe. According to some, this is only half the circumference. That's all it says in the purport. Krishna goes on. Some of the universes are 1 billion yojanas in diameter, some 1 trillion, some 10 trillion, some 100 trillion yojanas. Thus, they are almost unlimited in area. According to the size of the universe, there are so many heads on the body of Brahma, and this way I maintain innumerable universes, or brahmandas. No one can measure the length and breadth of the 1/4 of my energy manifested in the material world. Who then can measure the 3/4 that is manifested in the spiritual world? Beyond the river Viraja is the spiritual nature, which is indestructible, eternal, inexhaustible, and unlimited. It is the supreme abode consisting of 3/4 of the Lord's opulences. It is known as Paravyoma, the spiritual sky. What I just read, that's a verse from Padma Purana, spoken by Krishna. In this way, Lord Krishna bade farewell to the four-headed Brahma of this universe. We may thus understand that no one can calculate the extent of Krishna's energies. There is a very deep meaning of the word Tri Adishvara, which indicate that Krishna possesses 3 different lokas or natures. It's going on to another subject. I'll just read that purport. The word Tri Adishvara means proprietor of the 3 worlds. There are 3 worlds, and Lord Krishna is the supreme proprietor of them all. This is explained in by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, 5:29. What's 5:29 Bhagavad Gita? Bhoktaram dagatapasam sarvaloka maheshwaram suradam sarvabhutanam gyatvamam shanti mitchati. Translation. A person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities. So here's the part. The Supreme Lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. The word sarvaloka means, quote, all 3 worlds, unquote. And the word Maheshwara means the supreme proprietor. Krishna is the proprietor of both the material and the spiritual worlds. The spiritual world is divided into 2 portions, Goloka and Vaikuntha. The material world is a combination of universes unlimited in number. So there's apparently different ways of dividing or reading into or explaining Tri Adishvara, upper, middle, lower planetary systems. That's one. Goloka Vrindavan, Vaikuntha Dham, and this Devi Dham. And then the next, he's going into Goloka, Mathura, and Dwarka. Krishna lives eternally in these 3 places. But this is another subject. Let's go back to the other one. The topic is the chapter heading, the opulence and sweetness of Lord Krishna. So he's starting with the opulence, and he did a pretty convincing job of explaining the opulence of Krishna is unlimited. On occasions, Prabhupada would speak about religions. All religions say God is great. But then he would say, they do not know how great is God. Because to understand God is great, it implies we should serve him, because we're very small in comparison. Be so the great in comparison to the small should serve the great. I heard Prabhupada say this. Krishna consciousness is very simple. Three things. God is very great. I am very small. Therefore I should serve him. That is Krishna consciousness. And then, but how great he is, that they do not know. So, by material estimation, we can't conceive of such things as the greatness of God. A materialist, one whose source of information is the mind, and by agitating the mind, or expanding the mind, or speculating with the mind, one might try to conceive of the extent of God's potency. That's not the point being made, is that's not, you can't approach that, the extent of God's potency by that means. Fantastico ti shatabatsara sampragamyo vayo ratapi manaso munipungavanam. The Brahma Samhita verse describes through the medium of the mind, if the mind was traveling at the speed of the mind, so fast you can think of something, some other part of the world, and immediately the mind is there. That speed, and travel for millions and millions and millions of years, and still not be able to encompass the extent of Krishna's potency or touch the lotus feet of Krishna. The mind can't accomplish it. But by another process, by just as we heard in this little pastime, by Krishna extending his mercy, then one can understand something, like we discussed last night. The limited cannot possibly know the unlimited, because the limited is limited, and the unlimited is limited, so the limited can't possibly know that which is unlimited, unless the unlimited reveals. So here that lila that's being described is from Srimad Bhagavatam. But to show favor to Lord Brahma, who is a most qualified devotee, he helped Lord Brahma, as he did earlier, to understand the unlimited potencies of the personality of Godhead, the unlimitedness of the Lord's potencies. So both those lilas, Krishna's showing to Lord Brahma the unlimited forms of himself, identical with the calves and the cowherd boys, and that whole lila, Brahma Vimohan lila, and this lila, where not only unlimited numbers of Brahmas with so many 10 million heads, that must be very, how do you even think of that? How would an artist portray that? You've seen the painting, it's like a pyramid, so many heads and so many heads and so many heads, and each with helmets, and then another with so many heads and so many heads. (Clears throat) each of them could not see the other one, but one Lord Brahma could see all of them. It's, I don't understand that. You used to say, oh, it's mythology. That's one way. Just dismiss it. Or the Lord has inconceivable potencies. Jiva Goswami teaches in his Sandarbhas that without understanding this one thing, that God has inconceivable potencies, you can't possibly understand God. And then conversely, if you understand that God has inconceivable potencies, then one can enter into the realm of devotional service very easily. So this one thing is so important. But each, as described, each of the Brahmas that came, they were thinking, you have come into my jurisdiction. How does it work? There's all these unlimited universes. And each of them came to a place where they thought it was the Dwaraka within the Earth planet, within their universe. You follow? So you've come within my jurisdiction. You've come to my universe. My universe. This is false ego. And staying within the purview of the material covering, false ego is the first element that makes its appearance. There's a very fascinating description. You mentioned it last night in relation to universal form. We were reading from the universal form chapter. There's a place in the unfolding of creation where the personality of Godhead, Mahavishnu, is enjoying with his internal potency, Rama Devi. Doesn't describe what those activities are, but he's enjoying with his internal potency. But he who is, the way that Maitreya describes it, he who is complete, if there are living entities that can feel satisfied within, Atmaram, satisfied within, what to speak of the Supreme Lord? He's satisfied within. There is nothing outside of himself that is missing, and everything within himself is complete. But he feels something's missing. And the something that is missing is in the nature of love. And that is, there are living entities that are rebellious in spirit. And as a result, they're not experiencing their natural love for me. And because of that, they're incomplete. So that feeling prompts the Supreme Lord to bring forth creation. It's a feeling of love for the living entities. It's not the other kind where a wrathful God says, oh, I'm going to strike you down, and here comes your next suffering. You've angered me. Not like that. It's loving. So he brings forth creation. And he does so, as we know, in a number of ways. He glances over the pradhan. Living entities in time are carried by the glance. The undifferentiated totality of the material energy starts to become agitated, and differentiated out comes first false ego, our very dear friend, and then in contact with the modes of nature, false ego produces so many other elements, and everything is there. fast forward, there's demigods to see to the maintenance of the universe where the living entities can have an opportunity to try to enjoy or to try to restore their relationship with the Supreme Lord. But then the demigods offer prayers saying, we don't feel capable. Everything is there, but we don't feel we have the intelligence, we don't have the strength. Please impart them to us. So the Lord considers the prayers of the demigods, and he then manifests the universal form. And through the universal form, the elements that are there become energized. The comparison is made just like the elements of this body, by the presence of the soul within, they become energized or coordinated through the agency of super soul to perform, to come together and make a particular form and to be animated, because there's the presence of the soul. They appear to be animated and there appears to be consciousness within the body because of the presence of the soul. So also, it's very subtle, but so also the universal form, which is, although a temporary form of the Lord, it's a form of the Lord. And as the the universal form sees, then the living entity can see, because the universal form hears, the living entities can hear, and so on. And each of the senses becomes animated and activated because of the presence of the universal form. And do it in reverse. If the universal form is withdrawn, then we can't see, hear, smell, touch. The capacity of consciousness through the medium of matter is withdrawn. The soul isn't withdrawn, but the capacity of life is withdrawn. Life as we know it. So, with that somewhat parallel explanation, when all the Lord Brahmas are brought before Lord Krishna, they can see what he allows them to see. And they can't see what he does not allow them to see. Like us. We're able to be conscious of whatever Krishna permits us to be conscious of. An ant is conscious of whatever ants are conscious of. A human being is conscious of whatever human being, in different amongst the varieties of human beings. We're conscious of whatever the Lord permits us to be conscious of. Because he is conscious of everything. And he can exhibit that potency of being able to be conscious of something, just like the verse of Bhagavad Gita, Sarvashyaha Riddhi Sannivishto Matak Smritir Gyanam Apohanamcha. He's situated within the heart as the super soul, and from him comes whatever comes. It's a deep mystery. So how much covered are those living entities in the human form of life or other forms of life that don't have any awareness of this and think, I am this body, and that's all there is. And when the body is finished, everything is finished. And all the other things that those that don't have an understanding of the soul or the Supreme Soul, the relationship between the soul and the Supreme Soul, the different ways in which the Supreme Lord, through his opulences, is manifesting this unlimited spiritual realm. Who has the capacity of understanding that Lord Brahma has amongst all living beings? And we don't. And the capacity of Lord Brahma is completely under the control of the Supreme Lord. And if one thinks one's capacity is great, like might happen sometimes, then Krishna cuts one down to size. He does with Lord Brahma in this way. Come on over and pay me a visit. I want to see you. Oh, how fortunate. But Krishna's mercy upon Lord Brahma was to help him be proportionately humble in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's description of Trinadapi Sunichena, you know, the verse from Shikshastakam. Trin means straw. Trinadapi Sunichena. One should be more humble than a blade of grass or a straw in the street. So he says, as far as a straw is concerned or a blade of grass is concerned, they also have some false ego. But their false ego is proportionate to their existence. But as far as I'm concerned, my false ego is vastly disproportionate. I'm also very tiny, but I'm thinking so great. And whatever it is, that the tendency, through the agency of false ego, to think pridefully about whatever is my capacity. I can do something. I can do cartwheels. I was watching in the airport when a child was up and down the airport doing cartwheels and cartwheels and cartwheels. And everyone was fascinated, and they were doing because they wanted everyone to be fascinated how they can do cartwheels. So Krishna's given some ability, and I'm a cartwheeler. Whatever it is that one has ability-wise, it's insignificant. So if one can see oneself in relation to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we're insignificant, literally insignificant. And that's not low self-esteem, that's reality. We're insignificant. We're not zero, but we're insignificant. We're something. We're Krishna's part and parcel, but insignificant. And in that mood of insignificance or true absence of false humility, trinadapi sunichena, one can fathom far more greatly the unlimitedness of the Personality of Godhead. That's what this little section in Chaitanya Charitamrita is doing. We also know from Shikshastakam, one can then, it helps one to chant with taste, to chant with some real attraction for chanting. Until we get to that position of humility, we can chant, but the taste and the attraction for chanting isn't going to be the same. We can do so, we should do so, we do so with diligence. The Lord Brahma is the preceptor of our sampradaya. And we're best to learn from him. And in this case, it's the kind where he's not directly speaking to us, but he's being spoken to by the Supreme Lord. So we can, that the message is, in other words, the message is also for us. We're very, very tiny. And taking it into the arena of appreciation of Krishna's opulence and sweetness, this material portion, which is but one quarter, its vastness is inconceivable. Just to consider how intelligent Lord Brahma is or must be to put this universe together. Like Prabhupada says, you know, ask the scientist, make one mosquito. Well, Brahma made a bunch of mosquitoes. And not only the mosquito that can move in any direction at will, but reproduce itself and make another mosquito. Let them make one mosquito. Here's the elements. Go ahead. Brahma has that capacity. He assembles this universe. The ingredients are given, the plan is given, but he's what a engineer is Lord Brahma. And when he looks at the opulence of Lord Krishna, it's bewildering. So, what's our position? We're proud. That's our position. We're proud of something insignificant. To become freed from that is a nice project. And just by hearing, one can, to some degree at least, become freed from our sense of false pride. And that should be cultivated so that we can appreciate Krishna's unlimitedness. One last thing is this comparison between one quarter and three quarters. You know, the math is such that how is something that's unlimited, take either side, the opulences, even the Devi Dham opulences of the Supreme Lord, they're incalculable. So what's, you know, three times incalculable? How do you make the one quarter three quarters? That which is unlimited, and then you take out a quarter of it. It's done simply for comparison purposes. It's not, in other words, there's a pie and you cut out a quarter of the pie and then there's the other three quarters of the pie and that part's over here and this part's over here. Not like that. But it's something, it's not zero. It's illusory energy, but it's still Krishna's energy. It's transforming endlessly under his direction, but it's not zero, it's substantial. But the vastness of the spiritual sky is so far greater. So the rest of the chapter is going to go into describing the opulences of Krishna in the spiritual world. But for starters, please appreciate the opulences of Krishna in the spiritual world are unlimited, as his opulences in the material world are unlimited. It's a nice chapter. Okay, so any comments? Got the microphone ready here. Questions? Yes, how about? Nice to see you here. Didn't know you were here.
Yes, Maharaj. I was wondering, we live in such a culture of doubt in the modern world. We had about a month ago here in D.C., there was a rally for reason, where it was like an atheist assembly on the mall, and there are people just in outfits kind of mocking religion, and basically the idea is that, like, you know, if we could just get rid of this silly idea of God, then we could actually move forward. So especially these wondrous, inconceivable things in the present climate, how can we, you know, kind of connect with the people of this age?
Well, Prabhupada did it he didn't present pastimes like this to these people, but he would make a real basic challenge of, you know, reason, of why it is a foolish idea to rule out God's existence. So many. You've listened to Prabhupada speaking, so you know what Prabhupada says. If there is no God, then, you know, pose this question, that question, that question, and provide a plausible explanation. Whether it's, you know, chemical evolution or something, you know, just you say you're independent, that you're in control, then why this? So by reason, by logic, and hardcore people aren't going to be moved by that. But you present, and then they, and if you're clear in your Krishna consciousness, then the fence sitters, the borderline people, hearing this exchange may become moved. Well, wait a minute, yeah, that makes sense. That's one. There's a number of presentations that I make in universities and other places that are specifically for this audience. The scientific basis for reincarnation. Why is it that statistically so many people today, more persons, percentage of persons, accept reincarnation? Because there's evidence for it. It's not proof, but it's evidence for it. Or the presentation on Vedic cosmology is another one. That there's all these empiric things. If you say this is all myth and rubbish, then please explain how Vedic cosmology so accurately depicts our universe in quantifiable numbers. Go the other direction. And this is now from Sataputta, but he wrote an article in Bhaktivedanta magazine explaining that there was a certain period of time amongst European scholars where they were just finding out about the Vedas and they were fascinated by the Vedas. So there was like this big intellectual rush to go study the Vedas, learn Sanskrit and study the Vedas. And some of the Christian scholars were intimidated. So they started this anti-Vedas program. And by saying, it's rubbish, and here's two areas where it's rubbish, that you can prove it's rubbish. Those that are empiric. One of them was the creation. You know, saying that it's so old and how it happened. And another is cosmology. So through archaeology, as archaeology develops, it will prove itself that all this dating system of the Vedas is rubbish. And therefore the forbidden archaeology work is so important because it's empiric. But then the other was cosmology. That, you know, as technology develops, we will see that, you know, all of their distances between things is rubbish. But the cosmology, so it's empirical. Those literatures that accept the existence of God that existed long before technology existed, in very precise, quantifiable numbers, give details that those rishis, those seers, had access to. So how do they, if these people are rubbish people, how do they have empirical information that's so accurate? Or to it the other way around, that through advancement of technology is getting closer and closer to the picture of the rishis. So, you know, I've had dialogue with people like that. It doesn't exactly convince them, but it puts them off balance. I don't know how to answer that. There must be some explanation. I'll look into it. Okay, look into it. Good. When somebody has a predisposition, it's difficult. If the predisposition to persuade them to look at something other than their predisposition. Prabhupada said that the greatest, and you say, you know, that the age of doubt, Prabhupada spoke of it that the greatest obstacle for advancement of God consciousness in our present age is the blind faith that people have in science. If science says, then okay, I'll consider it. If science says something else, I'm not even going to consider it. So science has all these things that says there's no God. I mean, the very foundation of it is there's no God. All there is matter and the laws that govern matter, and everything can be explained that way. You don't need God. It's rubbish. That's the foundation. And they've got a stranglehold, and they're holding on to it very tightly. The intellectual base, as you know. So prying open the fingers of those intellectuals that have that tight hold is a major task. That other models than Big Bang cosmology and evolution can't be taught in schools. At least they can't be taught in science. They can be taught in philosophy and religion classes for the, you know, the weak-minded people. But the hard-minded people, you can't teach it. It's against the law. And it's being tested in the courts whether lawfully can be taught or not in science, and it can't be. They're winning. They've got a grip. So how do you deal with people that have a deeply invested purpose in holding on to their power base? It's tough. So we show the best response, at least from it's simple. We make presentations that can help them be a little off balance and not so blindly bought into the materialistic paradigm or the atheistic paradigm. And another is just good character by achar rather than prachar. Consistent. So that's something that we can work on. Good character. Good achar. Consistently. That can only be possible by good, strong Krishna consciousness. That's pretty convincing to many people. Anything else? Yes? Yes, here comes the microphone.
What happens if I have the, you know, I read someplace it's the Brahma's night, everything, there is no material creation anymore and everything goes down. So what happens to all the souls? Then, like me, what happens to me?
Well, you'll be going back to Godhead, hopefully.
Is it temporary?
Yeah.
If I don't go back.
Or whoever are those that don't go back. Yeah. During each night, it's discussed in Brihad Bhagavatamrita a little elaborately that up to the heavenly planets, Swargaloka, and down, everything is engulfed in fire. It becomes ashes. And then torrential rain, it becomes dissolved. So it's this big soup of dissolved matter in the Garbhadak ocean. And the living entities are suspended within the body of Lord Vishnu. And then as in the morning, Lord Brahma awakens and he does his sadhana, as a good Lord Brahma will do. And then he does his seva. He recreates. And the living entities, the pool of living entities, are within the body of Mahavishnu. Just like it's described, can you recall the description from the first canto, chapter 6, where Narada is describing to Vyasa what happens in his previous life. It comes at the end of the day of Lord Brahma, which is what you're asking about. He enters into the body of Lord Vishnu during the night of Lord Brahma. And during the next day, in the morning of Lord Brahma's next morning, he appears as the son of Brahma.
Oh,
Narada. So read that section, then you get a little clue.
So I have,
you have a follow-up, go right ahead.
So the spirit, the living entities are suspended, right? So there is no progress for them. Is that correct?
That's right.
No spiritual progress.
They're just hanging out.
That's 4 billion
years. It's a long time. But hey, you know, time is eternal.
That's inconceivable.
Okay. Okay, you inconceivable that one for a while. Someone else? Anyone else? Yes.
Maharaj, we're talking about the inconceivable potencies of the Supreme Lord. So if a person comes to understand that, and there is a tendency to see, okay, the Lord is having inconceivable potencies, and whatever past tense, like lifting the golden hill, is like just child's play for him. But at the same time, behind that is the love for the Supreme Lord, for his devotees, and
sure,
he's personally protecting.
Sure.
So how does the unfolding happen from understanding the inconceivable potencies to understanding the love of the Supreme Lord for
the They're proportionate. To the degree that there's some love for the personality of Godhead, then one can increasingly understand the inconceivableness of the Supreme Lord. Let's say, you know, we're chanting Hare Krishna. We're supposed to be anyways. We're chanting Hare Krishna. And from that chanting of Hare Krishna, what if one of the things that the chanting of Hare Krishna does is Shreya Kairava Chandrika Vitaranam. That's one of the things. The white lotus of good fortune is expanding, and that white lotus, the good fortune, is the desire to serve Krishna. It's the white lotus of good fortune is expanding. In the waxing full moon light, very beautiful poetic imagery, and that's what happens from the heart level, is the desire to serve Krishna is increasing, and proportionate to that desire to serve Krishna increasing, one's capacity to have, to be recipient of Krishna's mercy, to have Krishna disclose his greatness, his unlimitedness, it becomes possible, and the less one is going to understand that. So they happen proportionately. And the means is, for us, chanting of Krishna's holy name. And that's manifest mercy. And then how that touches our hearts is going to determine all the rest. Anything else? Yes? Here comes the microphone. You have a soft voice too. I think you'll need the microphone.
Hare Krishna.
Oh, much better.
It seems innately that the living entities, our eternal position is love and service to Krishna.
You got it.
And it seems that Krishna, is more eager for living entities to come back to him. So why create this? Why are living entities subjected to this suffering of being entangled in material?
Because we want it. What? We didn't want the suffering, we wanted the independent enjoyment part. But Krishna told us there's no independent enjoyment, there's no such thing. But we're like little children. I want to enjoy. No independent. I want to enjoy. I want to enjoy. I want to enjoy. There's no such thing. I want to enjoy. Prabhupada gives the example. A child sees the moon. Mommy, I want the moon. You can't have the moon. I want the moon. I want the moon. I want the moon. You know how kids are. They say it over and over again. I want the moon. Yeah, all right, all right, all right. Here's a mirror. Hold the mirror like this. Now you're holding the moon in your hand. And then the mirror moves. Now the moon went away. Mommy, mommy. We're like little children. We want independent enjoyment, but it doesn't exist. So instead, yehi samsparsha ja bhoga dukha yonaya evate. By that bhoga, by that samsparsha ja bhoga, by the intention of being an enjoyer, by bringing the senses in contact with sense objects, that's what we want. We want to be the enjoyer of Krishna's energy. We want to be Purusha. We're not, we're Prakriti. I want to be Purusha. All right, all right. Here's this illusory realm where you think that you're Purusha. Yay! But wait a minute, I'm getting dukkha instead of sukha. So your question is, why? And the answer is, we wanted it. Krishna doesn't want us to be here. He doesn't want us to try to seek illusory happiness and get distress instead. But that's the nature of the place. We wanted it. It's created because we wanted it. If we didn't want it, we wouldn't be here. We'd be somewhere else. We'd be with Krishna. But we want it. It's foolish. It's really just childish. Or worse than childish, it's animalish. Unrestricted sense gratification. That's what the conditioned soul wishes. There's no such thing. So then gradually, regulated, okay. Now, rise above it, okay. And then, you know, gradually you don't need it anymore. Okay. That's the source of all misery is ignorance. This misuse of free will is... there's no good reason for it. It's a mistake. That's why, though. Misuse of our free will, here we are. Something else? In the back here. Put your hand up so you know.
So, Maharaj, how to properly understand the conceived, Srila Prabhupada is with us. How to have a good.
Through sound. Through sound.
Sound is books. Is there something beyond that? Is it
proper? What do you mean beyond that?
Kind of, we have these deities in our temples.
But through sound. The understanding won't be there without sound. Sound. That's the doorway. Go through it. Proper, put your receivers on and hear the proper broadcasting and you get that presence. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.